As I was explaining earlier, tonight's discussion is really kind of preparatory for what we're going to be doing in the next couple of weeks. We really only have a couple of discussions left. We should be finished with this after two more discussions. So tonight is a little bit weird. It winds up setting the stage for everything that comes later. There was too much stuff for us to discuss if I broke this up and put it kind of with the last two. So this lesson is a little bit different than what we've been discussing so far. Tonight's lesson is kind of backing off and getting us some information that we'll be using in the future as we continue to talk about this. So tonight we're going to talk about writing materials and the way that and the language that the New Testament authors used in order to convey to us what God wanted us to know. The Bible is the result of documents that are not only ancient, but they were transmitted and preserved basically by means of writing. So the whole history of the Bible, the Bible itself, is dependent on two things: the history of the materials that they used in preparing these ancient books, and a little bit about kind of the history of language and the history of writing. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the materials that were used to record information really in ancient times. So the first kind of material, and one of the things that you'll notice as we go through this, is that there's a trade-off between materials that are durable and materials that are portable. Some materials are very durable, but they're not very portable. Some materials are very portable, but they're not very durable. So what was ancient writing done with? In other words, what materials did they use to record written material? Well, the first kind of material that they used, the earliest inscriptions that we found were inscriptions that were made on stone surfaces. And there are considerable portions of the oldest Hebrew writing that have ever been found in Palestine that are on stone. And you see examples of that. Biblically, we know at least part of the biblical record was recorded in stone. You think about the Ten Commandments in Exodus, the 31st chapter. And then those original 10 tablets broken by Moses were replaced with 10 tablets, those original tablets of stone that contained the 10 words were broken by Moses. And then Moses replaced them with stone tablets that he himself carved. So the replacement wasn't written by the hand of God like the original was. And we find this frequently in the image that you have on the screen, that's something called the Moabite stone, or it's the Mesha Stele. We usually call it the Moabite stone. And it's really interesting that this Moabite stone that the king of Moab recorded his exploits on follows very closely the events that are described in 2 Kings 3. Moab had been under the authority of Israel. They rebelled. 2 Kings, the third chapter, talks about Mesha, the king of Moab. He was a lamb breeder. He needed to provide the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the fleece of 100,000 rams. When Ahab passed away, Moab rebelled against the king of Jerusalem. King Jehoram marched out of Samaria at that time, and he summoned all of Israel. So it's also the earliest inscribed version of Yahweh, which would be the Hebrew proper name for God. And it also mentions King David. So the first kind of writing material that we have found, the most ancient, that confirms the Old Testament, the way it was written, is writing material on, or written material on stone. Extremely durable, not very portable. Second kind of writing material, this is kind of along about the same time that we had written material on stone, we also find that there were written materials that were recorded on clay tablets. It was an unbaked clay, it was inscribed, and then it was baked. And it turns out that we found huge libraries of these clay tablets that have been, that were found in Assyria and Babylon. And these clay tablets are something that's mentioned in Ezekiel, the fourth chapter, verse 1. So these clay tablets, as you might guess, they're extremely susceptible to breakage. And so they're more durable than some materials. But when we try to make them portable, we increase the risk of breakage. And so these clay tablets that we found, and this is just an illustration of a clay tablet, they sometimes wrote material on these clay tablets. Sometimes they wrote things on wood. And this is an example of what I'm told is an IOU that they have found that was written on a wooden tablet. So you had clay tablets, stone tablets. Now we find them using some wooden tablets. These were most often found in the area around Greece. These are not found so often in the area that the Israelites occupied, but there are some parts of the Bible that were written, at least partially written, on wooden tablets. And you see examples of that. Isaiah 30 at verse 8, Habakkuk, the second chapter at verse 2. This is usually something that was written, and apparently it would have been shown to those people that were receiving this information. wasn't really intended to be something that was permanent, but it was something that they did sometimes write on. Brown, Driver, and Briggs are the ones that say that this word tablet in Isaiah 30 and verse 8, and then again in Habakkuk at verse 2, they're the ones that I'm relying on to tell me that this word is probably a word that refers to a wooden tablet, because it sounds to me like when I read it that it might have even been a clay tablet. But Brown, Driver, and Briggs tell us that this is probably a wooden tablet. So, again, a little more portable, less prone to breakage than the clay tablet, but not terribly durable. And then they started using papyrus. Oh, excuse me. Before they used papyrus, they used leather. Leather was the principal material that was employed by the Hebrews for literary purposes. In fact, the Talmud says that any time Jewish law, and we're talking about the scriptures, any time that was copied, it had to be copied on animal skins. So the Talmud even goes so far as to require something be written on leather. There's a scribe's knife that's mentioned in Jeremiah, the 36th chapter, verse 23. And this scribe's knife that's mentioned there in Jeremiah, interestingly, is the kind of thing that they would have used so that they could erase material on leather. You could actually cut away a small top portion of the leather, and that way you could have a completed copy. So the scroll that's there in Jeremiah, because it's mentioned at the same time that the scribe's knife is mentioned, was probably a leather scroll. And my conclusion is that when the Apostle Paul writes to Timothy in 2 Timothy 4, and he asks him to bring him the parchments, this is probably what he was talking about. He was talking about copied portions of the Old Testament scriptures. In the New Testament era, most of the written material was on papyrus. And papyrus it's made from a plant that grows in abundance along the Nile River. Papyrus, generally speaking, were written in the form of a scroll. And what you have here is an ancient papyrus scroll. The scrolls would generally have been about 30 feet long and something like 9 or 10 inches high. The writing is usually done on just one side of the scroll, and you rolled and unrolled at the same time to keep a particular portion of that 30-foot long scroll visible to you. It was, most of the material was written in columns, so it wouldn't be written in one 30-foot long line. It was written in columns, pretty much like what we're familiar with in some of the verse organized copies of the New Testament. They're written in columns. These columns, from what we can understand looking at the ancient scrolls that we found, probably 3 or 4 inches wide. Sometime around the 1st or 2nd century AD, these scrolls began to be replaced by papyrus codexes. And a codex manuscript is a lot more like what we're familiar with. It's a book. So instead of being entirely rolled up, a papyrus codex would have been bound along one edge, and they usually were folded. Not always, but usually they were folded, and the sheets were bound on one edge. And this, given what we know from antiquity and archaeological research, is the most frequent way that the New Testament was copied so that it could be distributed. It's a material that was readily available. It's a material that is, generally speaking, portable. You remember when Eusebius made the 50 copies of the New Testament, or 50 copies of the Bible for Constantine? Those were probably written on a papyrus codex. A codex manuscript is what we generally find in antiquity when archaeologists find a portion of the Bible. This is not what they found when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. Those were scrolls back here. So they're a little bit older than the development of the codex. The codex didn't come along until 1st or 2nd century AD. So it's, the New Testament is written at a time when we're going through a transition from the scrolls to the codex. And then the next material that comes along that was used for the purpose of copying the New Testament is probably vellum. Now, vellum is really interesting. Originally, vellum meant the skins of calves or antelopes, while parchment referred to material that came from sheep and goats. That wasn't always something that was observed, but vellum is a more durable surface than the parchment. The two most valuable manuscripts in existence today of the Old Testament, of the Old and New Testament, are on high quality vellum. Vellum is very durable. What you see on the slide here is an actual signed copy of the Magna Carta. Now, the Magna Carta was signed 12th of October in 1297. So this material is about 800 years old. It's very, very durable, much more durable than papyrus. And up through the Middle Ages, this was the principal medium for writing the Word of God. If we wanted to make sure that it was going to be durable and it was going to be portable. Interestingly, as I was doing some of this research, I found out that the United Kingdom still to this day prints the original version of all of its laws on vellum, and they're stored in the Tower of London. There is this huge library of vellum laws in the Tower of London, and this stuff is incredibly durable. Now, we had an advantage in some ways. The New Testament was written in an area that lends itself to the preservation of natural materials. If you had developed the New Testament in the jungles, it would have deteriorated very quickly, no matter what it was written on, because stuff just doesn't last in the jungle. But if you do it in the desert, some of this material lasts for a long, long time. Most of the ink that they used wasn't nearly as durable as the materials that they eventually developed, especially the vellum. The ink was usually made from gum or charcoal, or sometimes it was lamp black that was mixed with water. So it's soot that you get when you burn a candle or you burn a lamp. And then it's mixed with water, so that the material was durable, but the ink begins to be a problem. So questions about the material that the New Testament, well, that the scriptures would have been written on. Okay, now all of that's important because we're going to continue talking about this, and we have to, when we talk about a codex or we talk about a vellum copy of something or a scroll, now you'll know what we're talking about when we talk about what we have found, and now we can look at it. Well, what about the languages? The New Testament, even the Old Testament, was not written in a language that I can understand. So it has to be translated. And that's the next part of understanding the development of the canon. Originally, the Old Testament is written in Hebrew. Some parts of it are written in Aramaic, and the New Testament, for the most part, is written in the Greek language. I made a mistake when I was in high school. I should have studied Greek. I didn't. I studied Latin. Would have suited me better if I had spent some time studying Greek. When I was preaching in Anchorage, I found out that you can take classes at the synagogue in the Hebrew language. And so I decided that I was going to take these classes. Interestingly, the rabbis teach these classes for free. And so I signed up for a class, and I walked in the first day. I'm a 40-year-old guy, and I sit down next to these 12-year-old kids who just beat me up because they were eating up this stuff about Hebrew, and I was really struggling to learn this. I got to the point where I could basically look things up. I knew the order of the alphabet, which I've forgotten by now, but I never did get very adept at the Hebrew language. Most of the Old Testament, though, is written in Hebrew. It's a Semitic language. That's the family of languages that it's in. It's not like English. English is a Germanic language. It's a Romance language. This is a Semitic language. So it's in the Semitic group. It's the Arabic, the Syriac, Akkadian, the Aramaic. These are the languages that are in the Semitic group. Semitic languages are written backwards. Well, from my perspective, they would say that our language is written backwards. But the Semitic language is written from right to left. We're not familiar with that. We're familiar with right or with left to right. But it was written right to left. And there are even developments in the Hebrew language that help us to date when something was written. The first thing that we know about the Hebrew language is that originally there are no vowels. The vowel points weren't added until about the time of the Masoretes. And you remember the Masoretes added the vowel points because without vowels, it's really hard to tell what a word might be. And we talked about some examples of that. Up until about 200 BC, Hebrew looked very angular. If you're familiar with Phoenician inscriptions, it looked like the Phoenician lettering. So you get up, down kind of pointed letters and letters that go up like this, and then you see flags coming off. That's kind of an angular shape. And some of the earliest Hebrew documents that we found are written in this kind of a shape. The Siloam inscription. The Moabite stone that we've talked about already is kind of a transition from this angular kind of writing to a square kind of writing that we're more familiar with. These square-shaped letters that we associate with Hebrew, those didn't start to be used until about 200 BC. The other thing that we know about the Hebrew language is that it's a very good language for recording historical facts, but it doesn't have the words that can describe abstractions. So in Hebrew, you have very little kind of philosophical thinking that's recorded for us. You get a little bit of it in the book of Ecclesiastes and in the book of Proverbs, but you just really don't see very much abstraction in the Hebrew language. And even the book of Ecclesiastes and the book of Proverbs are not so much abstractions as they are reasoning about the facts, the things that transpire. Then there are certain portions of the New Testament and the Old Testament that are written in the Aramaic language. Aramaic began to replace Hebrew about the time of the Babylonian exile. So around 500 BC, Aramaic becomes the common spoken language of the people of Palestine. In fact, one of the ways that the Judean Christians differentiated themselves from those that had gone to Babylon and returned was that the people that went to Babylon and returned, they spoke Aramaic, while the people that didn't go to Babylon continued to speak Hebrew, and they saw that as a badge of honor. The Jews that had gone into Babylon that had adopted some of the ways of Babylon came back, and they didn't always give their children, especially their male children, Hebrew names. And we see this tension between the whole naming thing. When you see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as the given names in Babylon for those three young men who were taken from Jerusalem to Babylon as a part of the exile. In fact, Daniel also gets a Babylonian name. I don't know why we seem to have picked up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's the way we know those three men, and that's their Babylonian name. And then Daniel, we know by his Hebrew name. So it's really interesting. So Aramaic is the common tongue that's spoken in Palestine. And I put down a listing of those parts of the Old Testament that are written in Hebrew, that are written in Aramaic. And there aren't very many of those parts. It's not surprising that a big portion of Daniel is written in Aramaic because it's related to what was spoken in Babylon. And a big portion of the book of Ezra is also written in Aramaic. And that, again, that's largely because it was addressed not to Hebrews, but it was addressed to foreigners. So Aramaic becomes the diplomatic language. It's the formal language in Assyria and Babylon and Persia. In fact, there's some evidence that, remember I talked about how the Hebrews started to use these square-shaped letters as opposed to the angular letters? The Aramaic language may have been the source for that change in the way that the Hebrew letters were formed.
Hey, Dean.
Yeah.
Hey, I have some examples of those three languages. If you want me to share my screen, I can show you what the Phoenician alphabet looked like. Yeah, give me just a second here. So this is a preview of the Phoenician language. So as you can see, what Dean was talking about with that particular language is very angular, very pointed. And you can see the whole alphabet, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you were talking about the, I'm going to be just a second here. I'm going to stop that share, and I'm going to share, this is the Hebrew alphabet. So it's a little bit smaller, but you can see it's more block shaped, a lot less angular. And the last one is a comparison chart that shows the three, many of the different languages together. And let me try that one here. This one gives you the Aramaic writing in the first four columns and then compares it to the Hebrew in the fifth column and then Phoenician in the eighth column and Arabic. And so you can see the difference in the character symbols.
Thanks, Ted.
Absolutely. You'll have to reshare your screen, though.
Okay. That's okay. I don't need to share my screen anymore. I'm finished with the slide that I have. I've always been impressed when I see Arabic writing that it, to me, it bears some resemblance to Hebrew writing, and that was what Ted was showing us. So there aren't very many parts of the New Testament that are written in Aramaic, although Aramaic is probably the language that Jesus spoke. You see just a few Aramaic words, Talithakumi, Eli, Eli lama sabachthani, statement that Jesus made when he was on the cross. Abba, it's interesting that that's an Aramaic word that was taken into the Hebrew language, and the word Maranatha. So those are Aramaic words that became a part of the Hebrew language. So Aramaic is the common language in Palestine and in the area, all of those areas around there, until the area is conquered by the Arabs and the Muslims in the 7th century. And then the vast majority of the New Testament is written in the Greek language. Jesus probably spoke Aramaic. And I'm guessing that most of the apostles probably spoke Aramaic, but they wrote in Koine Greek, which is not classical Greek. It's the common, ordinary, everyday Greek. Greek was spoken in the Aegean world for over 3,500 years, and it reaches back all the way to 800 BC. The oldest documents in Greek literature that we have that are written in the Greek language are the two epic poems of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey. We've probably all heard of those. We may not know exactly who that refers to or what that refers to, but those are two epic Greek poems that were written in about 800 BC. Palestine is incorporated into the Roman Empire in about something like 63 BC, 60 BC. Greek continued to be the common language, even in the Roman Empire, where the diplomatic language had become Latin. And there's a real good reason for that. When the Roman Empire started, the Etruscans, which is the forerunners of the Roman Empire, the Etruscans really had no written language. The Etruscans conquered the Greeks, Rome becomes the big dog on the block, but Rome still didn't have a written language, so they stole the Greeks. And most things were written in the Greek language, which gives us a really interesting look into the development of the term plagiarism. You file this away somewhere in the back of your mind. The Latin, the Romans, didn't really have a literature of their own. So they began to develop their own literature by translating what was written in the Greek into the Latin language. And they translated it word for word. That was what you were supposed to do.
So back in the day, the language of the people was Greek?
Yes. So the language that they spoke most of the time was Koine Greek. The language of the empire might have been Latin.
Right. Okay.
And interestingly, the original meaning of the term plagiarism was that you didn't copy word for word. Instead, you added something to it. That's a real, almost 180 degrees from what we think of as plagiarism today. Plagiarism in ancient Rome meant that you translated the Greek into Latin, but you didn't do a very good job of it, and you added some things of your own. That was called plagiarizing the Greek. Anyway, Koine Greek is spoken by most people. Latin is the language of the court and the language of the kings, but even most of the kings spoke Greek. Up until the beginning of the 3rd century, Greek appears to be the most frequently spoken language, even among the Roman church, even among the Romans in the Roman Empire. In fact, Paul sent his letter to the church in Rome in the Greek language, not in the Latin language. No portions of the New Testament were originally written in the Latin language. It was completed before that time. So, why do we spend so much time trying to figure out what language it was originally written in? We have to translate it. And that's the next thing that will, the next two classes. One will be talking about the process of copying. Why did they have to copy? Because the materials that they had weren't very durable. Then we'll talk about the process of translation. Why do we have to talk about translation? Because nothing that we have was ever written in English. It was all written in a very different language. And I don't know if you've ever tried to translate from one language to another. It's a very difficult process to translate from one language to another. Sometimes, especially with idioms and things that we say all the time, there is no way to translate word for word, because a word for word translation wouldn't make any sense because it was an idiom. So we have to go back and we have to kind of ignore the word for word, and we have to translate the idiom instead. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the evidence. Did they copy it correctly? Then we'll talk a little bit about translation. Did they, for the most part, translate it correctly so that what we have is an accurate copy of what God wanted us to know, written in our language so that we can understand it? So thanks for bearing with me tonight. That a lot of material that doesn't immediately get us closer to the end, but it's some of the material that we needed to know so we can get to the last couple of classes. Questions? Thank you. Thanks to Ted for that comparison of kind of the form of the letters And you wouldn't think about that. There were distinctions in the way that the letters were formed, and those distinctions help us know when that might have been written.
That's just the Greek or Koine Greek alphabet. We should all be familiar with that, I think.
Yep. We're definitely familiar with some of those letters. Pi, you see right here. We are familiar with sigma. If you did any work in statistics, you're familiar with sigma. You're familiar with alpha and omega, first and last. Alpha, beta, and gamma, if you took geometry.
Delta. And who of us haven't heard about the delta variant?
Yeah, the delta variant. Delta, if you've done math, delta is for change, epsilon, which is the summarizing symbol. Theta, if you've done test theories. So there's all kinds of things that we're familiar with. Mu, which is a different word for the mean. Sorry. I'll shut up. I could go on and on with those. So any other comments?
When the Old Testament was translated by the copiers, did they translate the Hebrew into Greek first?
Sometimes. That's really interesting. Sometimes they translated it from Hebrew into Greek and then into Latin, which was what Jerome did when he prepared the Vulgate. He used the Septuagint, which was the Greek version of the Hebrew Old Testament. And so now you've got two processes of translation, two sources of potential error. And then you had some people who translated into the Greek language and went back to the Hebrew. Or translated into Latin, but went back to the Hebrew instead of Hebrew, Greek, then Latin. They went Greek, then Latin. So yeah, that's the process of translation that we'll be talking about.
And then when we look at it, we're looking at English.
Yeah, that's right.
That's totally could be messed up.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And so did the people that translated it into English, did they start with Jerome's Latin Vulgate? If they did, remember the Vulgate went Hebrew, Greek, Latin, then it was translated into English.
Yeah.
Some of the newer translations, they're saying, look, we're getting, you know, this has been repeated over and over again. It's kind of like that game that kids play where you tell a secret to the next person in line and it goes down the line. Every time it gets transmitted, a little bit of it gets lost or garbled. Well, some of the newer translations, people are saying, wait a minute, we ought to go back to the Hebrew and translate it out of the Hebrew, or go back to the Greek and translate it out of the Greek. And then you get something else that gets built into this. You get translations that aren't really quite for the purpose of making it accessible to to the common people. Martin Luther translated the Bible. He translated it into the common vernacular, but he did it really to poke a thumb in the eye of the Roman Catholic Church. And so you get some kind of knife twisting that gets incorporated in there, because it wasn't only a translation, it was also a political statement. And that gets really complicated. And I don't remember for certain. I will know this by the time that we talk about it. I believe that there are some translations that we're familiar with that are not translations from the original language, but it's people who took the King James and updated the King James. So that's people that translated it into English. And then we wanted to have a more modern sounding translation, something that we could more easily read. So instead of going back to the original, we just went back to the King James. So any mistake that was kind of baked into the King James got baked into this new translation. There are an awful lot of opportunities for us to get errors in here. And I think when we finish this, what you'll be amazed at is in spite of all the opportunities to get errors in here, if we can finally manage to take a translation that we have today and compare it using the best scholarship that we know to the oldest document that we have, we did a really good job. So, questions? I hope this will all make a little bit more sense when we finally get to talk about transmission and translation.
Dean?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say that when you talk about Martin Luther King translating
Martin Luther,
translating that it being sort of a political and a poke in an eye, but it really was his conviction that they were keeping the word of God away from people, and that people didn't need to have that intermediary. And so it feels like people will say, well, that's political, but it was his convictions that they were doing it wrong. And I just want to know if we have to stand on our convictions that it may not be political.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm not saying that Martin Luther in every case did a bad job with translating the Latin scriptures. I think he did a marvelous job. You just have to remember there was a little bit of political poking that went on in that. I think we today are familiar with people who, when they write history, can have an axe to grind, and history gets rewritten, and it's mostly correct, but not quite correct. So we just have to be aware of that. But a good point. Good point, Carol. He did want to make sure that the people had access to the scriptures in the common vernacular. Now, I'm not sure exactly how much good that did because most people were illiterate. And I guess the next step that we would have to take in order to try to understand this is to look at literacy. You know, people in the Middle Ages were basically illiterate, and they depended upon art. And the biblical stories being translated into a visual medium to have access to what was in the biblical story because they couldn't read. And I worry that we may get to the point in our country where a great number of people don't read very well. And because they don't read very well, they won't be able to access biblical information. You know, I read somewhere many years ago that McDonald's stopped putting the names of their menu items on their cash registers. Instead, they put pictures because people couldn't read well enough to read the names. That's a sad commentary, but it's probably going to impact the way we have to teach biblical information.
Dean?
Yeah.
When I would say anything to a lot of people in Europe, that were raised Catholic, they would just say, "We can't understand it." So they bypass reading it. It's, we can't understand it. We have to have the priest explain it. And so we just live our life the way we want.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. And not only that, it made it easy for the priests to prey on those people that had never read the Bible for themselves.
Yeah.
And we don't ever want to get to that point.
In the mountain villages, the priest is the head honcho of the village.
Oh, yeah.
They call him father. They take an extra step around him. They take him food.
I can kind of understand that if you're illiterate and this person says, "I'll tell you what this says," that's the best you can do. I think the lesson to learn from that in part is never forget how to read. If you forget how to read, doesn't matter whether you can understand it or not, if you don't know what it says. That's why in the Old Testament, because literacy was not widespread, the priests would assemble the congregation and they would read the law out loud. But even then, you have to depend on them actually reading what it says.
Well, that's the same thing for the first century Christians who were illiterate. I know some of the people had spiritual gifts that were enabled to convey God's word, but then you had to rely on those people, and that's when Gnostics came in and they used their trickery to pull people away from God.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. So we have to be very, I can't tell you how important I think it is that we teach our children how to read. That we we make sure that they have access to what the Bible really says. Now, we're not going to teach them Greek. We're not going to teach them how to translate it. We're going to have some reliance on the goodwill of the people that have given us what we have. But we at least need to know how to read what we have. And if you have 40 different translations and you can read all of them, that makes it even harder for somebody to lie to you and say, oh, well, that's not what this says. So I'm a big fan, a big proponent of reading lots of different translations, lots of different versions of the New Testament. Well, guys, we went over time just a little bit tonight. Thank you for your kind attention and all of your questions 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 and all of your questions.